Hi, I'm Jasmine Cephas Jones.
Hi, I'm Kenny M. Green.
Hi, I'm Kirsten Childs.
Hi, I'm Kalina Bovell, and you're listening to the Call and Response Podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Call and Response Podcast with Felicia Fitzpatrick. And like every other week, I am so hype, I'm so thrilled, and I'm so excited to talk to this week's guest. Like, I have been geeking out since I've learned about who she is, but also in preparation for this interview, I've learned so much, and I'm so excited to chat with her. She has been noted as one of the brightest stars in the world of classical music, and she is the assistant conductor to the Memphis Symphony and the conductor of the Memphis Youth Symphony. So I got to learn about her through Rob McClure's Conductor Cam series collaboration, which we will definitely get into in this interview. I'm just so excited to learn more about her and her journey and the world of classical music, because I don't really know much about it. But hello, please welcome Kalina Bovell. Hi.
Oh, hey. Hi. Hey, Felicia. How you doing?
I am doing so good. I'm so excited to talk to you, and this is what I've been looking forward to, like, all day, honestly.
Well, you know, awesome, me as well. And then thank you for that fantastic introduction. So I am so curious as to what you're going to ask me, you know, because I don't know any questions. I don't like having questions beforehand because I just really love an honest dialogue. So I'm super excited.
Yes, honest dialogue. I love it. I love it. We will go off the cuff and stay organic. I think it's one of those things where, like, being vulnerable and being courageous is really important these days. And So, I mean, I'm ready to dive in. And with that being said, my favorite question to start the interview is to know, how did you get involved with performing arts?
I started singing when I was 9, and it was kind of by accident because as a kid, I was never curious to see if I had any type of talent outside of karate. So like, I was a huge Jean-Claude Van Damme fan. I'm talking like huge. I had posters on the wall. I watched every movie. My favorite movie to this day is still Bloodsport. And so I was like all about karate, right? But it was in elementary school when the choir teacher went to every classroom and would pull every student out and tell them to sing this note. And so when she told me to sing the note and I held pitch and I was like, oh, well, shoot, I didn't know that I could sing. And that's kind of how I got started singing, you know, and that's how I was basically my introduction to music.
That's amazing. I love that. I love it. And then so who were the artists, like TV or film or music, that inspired you as you were beginning to like dabble in the music scene?
Well, you know, that's what's interesting. So before I started singing, I never really paid music too much attention. You know, meaning like in the household, we had, you know, Marvin Gaye playing and like Aretha Franklin and Nita Baker and like Celia Cruz and El General, you know, Selena, like those type of people. But before I got involved in choir, it was like, yeah, music is on the radio, but it didn't really call to me. But once I actually started singing, all of a sudden it was like, oh man, TLC and who else? Whitney Houston, Dionne Warwick, Toni Braxton. You know, it's like I started paying even more attention to R&B that was on the radio. You know, R. Kelly was big back then. R. Kelly's not big now. Okay, let's just put that out there. But R. Kelly was big back then. And so I really started paying attention to who these artists were and would try to imitate the way that they sounded.
Oh, that's so interesting. Okay. And yes, shout out to TLC icons. So you're dabbling in music. You're paying more attention to music. How did you discover conducting specifically?
So conducting, I feel like this is kind of the story of my life. Conducting was honestly by accident and by chance. And in college and university, I was a music education major. And every music major had to take a year of instrumental conducting and a semester of choral conducting. So during my sophomore year, it was time for me to take instrumental conducting. And, you know, it's always the basics of learning the patterns, learning how to generally read a score, just learning about the instruments. And mind you, in college, I was a violin player, you know, and I was convinced that I was going to be a violinist and I was going to be a soloist and I was going to be, you know, soloing with New York Phil and selling out Carnegie Hall. Like, that was the idea that I had for myself. But I kept getting injured and it was kind of like, this isn't working out for me. Injuries have been a part of my life, but that's a whole story for another time. But I was in this conducting class and, you know, it was my turn to get on the podium and kind of do the things that we had learned a week prior. And it was just giving that first downbeat, you know, and we were all musicians. And so we would sing or play our instruments for each other because we didn't have an orchestra. So we kind of formed our mini classroom ensemble. And so it was like when I heard the sound that my colleagues made as I was giving these beats, you know, and it was kind of like, okay, I'm interested in this. And it was for me just kind of one, this realization that there was this art form that I had no idea about. And then two, knowing that my gestures, whatever they may be, can influence and mold and shape the sound that's coming out from the musicians in front of me.
Oh, right. Like there's kind of a little bit of power in that, right?
I mean, yeah, definitely. But you know, what's interesting is as a violin player, I hate being kind of like the first violin section or in the first violin section. Like I like being in the second violin section because that really is the harmony. You know, it's like you're in the thick of the sound. And so it's interesting as a conductor, it's like, you know, some people think you are in charge, but it's like, really, it's like, no, you're in the thick of the sound, you know, and I just love being in the middle of it.
Yes. Okay. So wait, I'm curious because I found a video of you conducting and you can tell that you are like so in it. And so I guess I'm curious, like, how do you stay focused, but also like be present with the music? Because that process is just, that's fascinating to me.
Oh, you know, that's a good question. I forget if it was Michael Tilton Thomas, who is conductor of the New World Symphony, and he was conductor of the San Francisco Symphony. I believe it was he who said a conductor basically has to be three people at the same time because you're living in the present, but then you're thinking about what just happened. And then you're also thinking about what's coming up. Mm-hmm. And so it's like you have these three different mindsets. And I think honestly, the way that you just stay present and you stay focused is that you have to stay in the moment of the music. And it's almost like you have to connect to what's going on around you. And the moment you disengage, that's when you lose the ensemble.
Interesting. That's such an interesting way to look at it too. Yeah. And so you were saying like you were you were saying you are a violinist too. Do you know how to play like the tuba and like the woodwinds, clarinet, and like all of the different, I don't know, instrument families?
No, I mean, so we took a methods class. So there were string methods where, you know, you learn to play certain string instruments. As a violinist, they were like, okay, well, you can't learn viola because it's similar. And I was like, what? But no, it's not. But I learned cello. So, cello was very difficult because the strings are thicker and, you know, my hands are small. So I actually had a lot of difficulty playing cello and strings method class. Plus, I also had tendonitis. And so it's like when you have to use a little bit more force to pull or push the strings down, it was like, yeah, this is flaring up my tendonitis. There was a woodwinds method class where you learn to play flute, clarinet, I believe saxophone. And then there was brass methods where you learn trombone and trumpet. So, I mean, I dabbled, but can I play them effectively or well? No, but as a conductor, I'm able to read the notes that they're able to play. And I know the register and I know what the notes will sound like, just by sitting at a piano and plunking out the notes.
Right. So like treble versus bass clef.
Exactly. Treble versus bass. Whereas, you know, if you have a clarinet that's in a certain key, you might need to switch into soprano clef. So like those are all the skills that I learned in grad school.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So then when you were younger, what drew you to violin specifically as your instrument?
Again, it was by accident. So
I love it.
It's like this is the story of my life. No, coming out of elementary school. So going into middle school, I went to a school called Webster Middle School. And I was convinced that I was going to be a singer, you know. So when I latched on to singing, it was like, okay, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. Like no one could tell me anything. And my friends and I in elementary school, we had formed a little girl group. You know, we wrote our own songs. We did our own choreography. We would go around to the different classrooms and perform. Like we were serious, you know.
Yay.
And so when I went to middle school and I got my schedule, and it said beginning strings. I said, "Oh no, we don't do strings. We do choir. I sing, you know." Right. And so I went to the counseling office and I said, "You know, I'm sorry. I'd like to be in the choir." And they said, "Well, choir does not fit in your schedule, so we put you in this beginning strings class." I was like, "Okay, that's great." I was like, "But you're not hearing me. I don't do strings. Like I sing."
Right.
You know, I was like, what are you missing about this? And so, of course, little 12-year-old me is very stubborn. And they were like, well, we don't know what to tell you because you're in beginning strings class. And so that's kind of how I came to violin. You know, it fit in my schedule. I didn't know anything about the strings family. I didn't know anything about orchestra. So it was this brand new world that was opened up. And what was interesting was it was kind of a similar situation to when I started singing. The strings teacher, whose name was Joe Taylor, we used to call him Taylor back then. Taylor asked everyone in the classroom, okay, what do you want to play? And me not knowing anything about strings family, you know, when he got to me, I said, okay, I am going to play the flute, sir. And he kind of looks at me, he was like, what are you, an idiot? Like, go grab a violin, you know? And it was like, oh, I guess we don't do flutes in here. Okay. But, you know, I went, grabbed a violin, and it was, you know, it was very similar, again, to the, you learn first instrument maintenance, how to, like, open the case, how to hold the instrument, you know, how to safely pack up. You learn all these things. And when you start learning to play, it's what we call pizzicato, which is a way of plucking the string with the finger to make sound. But then when you start bowing, it was that first time I bowed, and I was kind of like, okay, now what is this? And why have I never known about this before? And again, it was kind of like a focus from, okay, I love singing, but now I love violin, and violin is what I want to do for the rest of my life.
Yeah, you know, that's powerful though. Like, I know it was an accident, but I love that, you know?
You know, it's like, I think I was a precocious child, and I'm not even going to apologize for that. But no, there was something about violin that just really called to me. And, you know, I never wanted to put it down, you know, because honestly, like, once I started playing and once I got over the sounding like a cat dying phase, you know, which is usually about 6 months to 3 years later. Like, I was just kind of like, no, this is my instrument. And I practiced all the time, you know, and I was very late to classical music because I started playing violin when I was 11. And so I was 7 years self-taught in the public school system, meaning I didn't have a private teacher until I was 18. So everything I had learned was from looking and observing my colleagues and then trying to imitate what they did, you know. But because I think also because of that, I was even more driven to try and figure it out because I didn't have a teacher who could guide me.
Right. And I want to hear about that because I associate classical music with, like, ballet, you know, because it's one of those things where some kids are in the studios rehearsing 6 days a week, 4 hours a day. And, like, is that true for the classical musical world, too?
Oh, yeah, most definitely. I mean, when I was an undergrad, my teacher, it didn't matter if you were music education or performance, he expected all of his students to practice 5 hours a day. And you did it. You know what I mean? And I lost friends because my friends didn't understand why I couldn't come and hang out today, you know, because it was like, oh, I got to meet my five hours. Like, I'm not done practicing. But when I first started, I think I was practicing maybe an hour and a half to 2 hours a day. Mm-hmm. But I was that kid, like, I kid you not. I used to practice in my parents' bedroom because we lived in a 2-bedroom apartment. And I had, like, the whole setup and, you know, I'd set the violin case up on the bed and, like, focus my music or, stand the music on the case. And that's how I practice. And my mom would, like yell at me. She'd be like, are you done yet? Like, I'm trying to go to sleep. And I'd be like, no, I got 45 minutes left. I don't know what to tell you, you know. So I was that kid, you know. Like, I there was just something about violin. And I just wanted to keep practicing because I wanted to get better.
Yes. I totally love that because I don't know. I've been thinking about this a lot of, like, as kids and as teens or even as, like, young adults, we have such fearlessness. And it's like you look back at things you did as a kid now and you're like, how did I even for me, I'm like, I would never do that now. I'm too scared. Right. But did you ever feel any, like, stress or pressure pursuing classical music because you were self-taught, or was that you just had a drive that kept you going?
I don't know that I ever felt pressure looking back. I know definitely it was a drive. And I think the drive came from when I first started playing in sixth grade, there was a student in my classroom, my colleague, who I remember one day he said this and it was just still very vivid. You know, he said, yeah, you know, you'll never be good because you're not Asian. Oh. And I was like, oh, I was like, really? And so for me, I've always been that person. You tell me I can't do something, I'm going to prove you wrong. And so I think for me, the drive started then to be like, okay, I'm going to have to prove this kid wrong, you know? Yeah. But then it eventually turned into, okay, but I'm actually sounding good because I'm practicing and that work that I'm putting into this is paying off. So I'm going to keep practicing.
Right. Right.
But then also, you know, just, but then it's kind of like a double-edged sword because you're practicing, but then you realized how behind you are or certain skill sets that you don't have. And so you're constantly practicing so that you can obtain those skill sets.
Yeah. 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 And honestly, anytime I see a Black musician or artist thriving in like a classical space, like classical music or ballet or anything like that, I'm always reminded of Nina Simone because of her wanting to be a classical pianist and her being told, no, this is not the genre for you. And so, yeah, so what I see people do, I'm like, yes, y'all are thriving, get it. But I'm curious, like, that guy told you you'll never be good because you're not Asian, you won't succeed. Is that isolating to you? Was that isolating to you?
That's a good question. Well, firstly, what do you mean when you say, is that isolating?
I guess, and maybe I'm projecting my personal experience of, like, doing ballet as a kid and not seeing any Black women ballerinas, you know, seeing anyone like me. I didn't have Misty Copeland. And I know there were Black ballerinas who existed back then, but, like, we merely had Google, and they weren't as, like, accessible as she has become, you know, in terms of representation. So I felt like no one else could really relate to or understand doing ballet as a Black girl.
I got you. What's interesting, is though, is that when I first started playing, I didn't notice the lack of musicians of color because Taylor was a Black man. And then most of the kids who went to Webster were predominantly Black, you know, so most of like the students in beginning strings were Black. Like my best friend played violin, you know, and I, and she's always like, oh yeah, I forgot that I played that because it's like, you know, we both played, but I kept going. And, and so Taylor always made sure to expose me to other musicians of color, whether it was different videos that he would show us in class or field trips that we would take, or, because he saw something in me, you know, he would kind of let me do extracurricular ensembles. So there was an ensemble called Sweet Strings, which was started by a woman named Kika Keith, whose daughter was also named Kika. So Little Kika, as they would call her. So Little Kika was a really great violin player, but her mother saw that, you know, there wasn't really any outlet for students of color. And so she started this Sweet Strings Orchestra. And so I was a part of that. So, you know, looking around, it's like, okay, here are 30 other kids who are Black. So for me, it was never really this notion of, oh, I'm in this isolated field because I'm surrounded by Black musicians all the time. It honestly wasn't until I got to high school and then eventually to college where I started noticing the lack of diversity in the field.
I mean, that's great that you were able to, like, start your journey surrounded by musicians of color and Black musicians. Do you feel like overall, like, in terms of the, I guess, professional field? I mean, it feels like it's very a white male-driven field. Do you think that's changing?
I mean, so the field is definitely still white male-dominated, you know? And I think I read a statistic the other day that said, what, musicians of color make up 2% of classical music.
Wow.
And I mean, that's a really low number, you know? And so is it changing? Yes, it is changing, but it's changing very slowly. And that's the problem.
Right. Right. Yeah. So, I mean, since you work with the Memphis Youth Symphony, I think education, like, I mean, even thinking about you going to your class and, you know, choosing the violin from the string section. I think education can be such an important tool in pressing forward for equity and inclusion in these spaces, especially the arts. What have you found during your time of working with the Youth Symphony in terms of, like, you know, educating the next generation?
Well, you know, the thing about the Youth Symphony is trying to increase the diversity within the organization as a whole. And I'm talking top down. You know, so, and one of my students, he's graduated now, but he was a senior bass player. And after he graduated, he sent me a message. It was via Zoom because we were honoring all of our seniors who were graduating. But he sent me a message and he said, you know, Mrs. B, when I saw you walk into rehearsal the first time, I thought, yep, this is my conductor, because here's someone who looks like me.
Wow.
And so, you know, one, I think it's really important for kids to see someone who looks like them. You know, you touched on it earlier. When I was coming up as a violin player, you know, even though I had my colleagues, I never saw any professional violinist outside of Regina Carter, who was a famous jazz violinist. You know, I don't do jazz, you know.
Right.
And even when I started conducting, I was still kind of operating in this narrow field, but I didn't know a lot of Black conductors who existed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's one, because the education about who they were wasn't there. I mean, and that's another thing. Classical education is so Euro-centered that you don't learn about Western classical music. You know, you learn about Brahms, Beethoven, Mozart, Haydn. That's great. But what about the people right here in our own backyards?
Right.
You know, so I think with the Youth Symphony, I have always tried to expose them to music that is reflective of their community. And that's also reflective of my community, you know, because mm-hmm. I come from that community. And then I also try to empower them to know that giving 100% is the thing that is going to propel you forward, you know? Yeah. And honestly, if you do decide to continue with music, you're going to have a work ethic that mm-hmm. Allows you to have thick skin for this field and for this business. Cause it's not easy.
No, it is not. No. I mean, you're right. But see, that's gotta be so empowering, that story you just told. Like, you are out here inspiring the youth, okay?
Yeah, no, you know, like, education has always been big to me and has always been important to me. You know, my parents come from Panama, when I take the accent off. My parents come from Panama, you know, and it's like, why do most immigrants come to the United States for a chance of a better education?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so the one thing that was always talked about, drilled into us, I have an older brother, so drilled into us when we were growing up, was education, learning, studying, knowing your books, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I honestly thought that I was going to be either a teacher or a doctor, because that was kind of the route that I felt that I was being pushed into. So when music happened, it was kind of like, well, I'm going to veer left and we're going to see what happens. But even as I veered left, education has always been important, because for me in my journey, there were so many educational opportunities that I didn't have access to. And so I feel that it is also my duty in this platform that I have to bring those educational opportunities to students, to young children, to families, to parents, you know, because I want people to be able to take part in things that I never got to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's exciting. Like, it's exciting to hear that you're embracing that, you know, and it could, like, rightfully so, like we were saying, be a stress or a pressure for some folks. But the fact that you're so into it is just, like, really cool to hear.
Oh, most definitely. You know, it's like, it's so cliche to be like, oh, music is my life. It's like, you know, I do other things, of course. But, you know, music is honestly, it is what I love, you know, and I just want to bring my love for music and my passion for it to other people.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I love that. And I want to hear about your journey to Memphis Symphony and your, like, unofficial debut that you made with Tony winner Leslie Odom Jr.
Oh, that was so much fun. So the journey to Memphis was interesting. So I was in a conducting fellowship program called the Chicago Sinfonietta, and the music director of Chicago Sinfonietta is Mayan Chen, who was the former music director of the Memphis Symphony. So her tenure ended in 2016, if I'm remembering correctly. And so Memphis didn't have an assistant conductor then. And, you know, as part of this fellowship program, Mayan is very dedicated to helping all of the fellows who go through this program. And so I remember she called me on Thanksgiving one day, and I didn't know the number. And I was like, well, who's calling me at like 7 p.m. California time? So I answered. And, you know, she was like, oh, Kalina, this is Mayan. I was like, oh, my God, why are you calling me? Like, this is amazing. But she said how she had a dream, and she had had this idea of bringing me to Memphis to help assist her with her final Masterworks concert, and if I could make it possible. And, you know, financially, I've always had financial struggles, you know, mainly because my parents worked paycheck to paycheck. And so nothing wrong with that. But it also makes you realize what is and what isn't a necessity. So this trip would have been very difficult, but through the Mayan Circle of Friends, which is a philanthropist organization of women, you know, they pulled together and were able to bring me to Memphis. And so that's how how I started my relationship with the Memphis Symphony. And so what's interesting was 2 years later, the position for assistant conductor opened up and I applied and I got a phone interview. And so I interviewed with my current music director, Robert Moody. It went great, but I didn't get a call back for an in-person. I was like, that's totally fine. You know, so I was working at a boarding school, fast forward 2019, I'm in my office about to teach class in 10 minutes. And I get this email from Bob saying, you know, Memphis has an assistant conductor position opening up. Would you be interested in applying? If so, feel free to give me a call. And I was like, oh my God, I have class in like 8 minutes. I don't care, because what I care most about is like calling this man to find out when I need to get on this plane. Right. So I called Bob and I said, hey, you know, just got your email. I'm interested. I would love to hear more information. Like, I was totally playing it cool. But on the inside, I was legit like, you just need to tell me when to get on the plane because I will be there. That's all I need to know. So told me with the audition information. I flew here in May. The audition was, what was it, 1 day total, but it was over 2 days because we got to see the Youth Symphony concert. It was a Youth Symphony side-by-side with the Memphis Symphony Orchestra, which is the big end-of-the-year concert for the Youth Symphony. And then the audition happened the next day. And so, I mean, it was a great process. And the thing I loved the most about the audition was coming back and seeing people who were here back in 2016 when I was here, who still remembered me, you know. Yeah. So just like walking down the hall and people like, oh, hey, sweetie, how you doing? And be like, wait, you actually remember who I am, you know? And and so it's like to see that relationship was still there, you know, and that bond was still there. It just, it felt like home, you know, and that's what I really love about this position and this job and the people that I get to work with.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I love hearing that it's like a true community. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to hear about that. And we need to like break it down for the basics for me, because I'm not super familiar with the classical musical world and conducting, of course. But I guess let's just break it all the way down. You know, in terms of a season, what does a conductor, what does an assistant conductor do during non-performance days, during performance days?
Oh, I feel like my life is so boring.
Oh my gosh.
Okay, so like pre-COVID days, I'm gonna take you through a typical like day when there are no concerts or like meetings or anything. There was a time I was waking up at 4:30 in the morning and I would study for 2 hours. And then I would go to the gym for an hour and a half, come back, breakfast, and then I would study. And so I used to study about 6 hours a day back then. And so if we have, if it's the week of a concert, usually we would have rehearsals on Wednesday night. We'd have a double rehearsal on Thursday. So meaning Thursday afternoon, Thursday evening. And then Friday night, we'd have a dress rehearsal and then concerts on Saturday and Sunday. So if it's in the middle of a rehearsal week, then I already know that I'm typically not going to study as much as I would normally get when we don't have a concert. But in the current COVID climate, you know, obviously we have not, we haven't done much, especially since New Year started, but we did have in-person concerts back in October. We had our Holiday Pops concert in December, and then we're looking forward to having resuming our in-person concerts in March. So right now I'm preparing music for those concerts and my schedule has changed ever so slightly. So I'm not waking up at 4:30 or even like 6 o'clock. It's like now it's like if I work out 3 to 4 times a week. And so I wake up between 7 and 7:30. I work out, eat breakfast. I study for an hour and a half. And I like to do the Pomodoro method, which is you do a chunk of work, take a break, and then do another chunk. So I do 45 minutes, 10-minute break, 45 minutes. And it's like, okay, 90 minutes are done. I'm going to watch Frasier. I might listen to an audiobook. Let me go grab a coffee right quick. You know, like I enjoy life.
Yeah.
Do a little bit of, do some computer work. And then later it's like, okay, it's time to do another study session.
So when we talk about studying, what is that process for you?
You know, it varies. And by that, I mean, I'm trying something different right now. So what the process is, I'll give you an example. So I'm supposed to have my concert debut this April, 2021. And one of the pieces I'm learning is a piano concerto. And so it's a piece that I've never known before. So it's brand new to me. So one, it's listening through it just to get a sense of the piece. I'm trying to understand the composer's kind of like sonic world, and even their language, their compositional language. And then I'm just going through and looking at the string writing, you know? And so you're looking at things vertically to see what's going on. And then you're looking at things horizontally to see what's going on. And then I also sit at the piano. I'm not a pianist, but I sit at the piano and I try to play through the lines so that I can get it into my ear. And then recently I've been kind of bringing back the college days of doing some sight singing and some aural skills training, which is basically I'm singing intervals to get those into my body. So I know what they sound like when I see them on paper. So I'm doing a lot of different things to prepare for the music this year, because I'm always trying to elevate myself and make my skill sets better.
Yeah, I know I keep saying fascinating, but this is also fascinating. Because then do you feel like the pieces are put together once you're at rehearsals with the musicians?
You would hope so, but... you know, but that's the thing, though. It's like, you put in all this work to learn this music. You know what I'm saying? Like this concert is not until April, but I'm going to be living with this score for the next 3.5 months or so. Right. And so you would hope that you have all of your ideas, that your vision is clear by the time you get to that first rehearsal. But the thing of it is that even after the first rehearsal and even after the concerts are done, you're still never done with the piece, because there's going to be more that you're going to want to do when you eventually revisit it later in your career.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, this is your take on it right now in these 3 months of how you could interpret it, but it could be completely different in a few years.
Exactly. You know, what's funny is that it could be, let's say, February 20th, and you're like, okay, I have my interpretation down pat. But then the next day you might think, oh, I didn't notice this before. And then that completely changes your interpretation.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. Ugh. And this might be a hard question to answer, but what is your favorite, like, do you have a favorite piece that you love to conduct or to listen to or just like experience, you know, sonically?
Oh, yeah, totally. Brahms. So Brahms is my composer. And like the way I say it, you know how people have like spirit animals, you know, like I have a spirit composer and his name is Brahms, you know. I love Brahms. It's especially his Second Symphony. I basically strongly believe that my conducting life started with that Second Symphony. And so it's one that I listen to often. And it's also one of my dream pieces to conduct.
Oh my gosh, yes. I want it to happen and I want to be in the audience. That is so cool. It's so exciting to see you thriving in the classical space. Like, I don't think we see that many Black women conductors. And I mean, I don't even know the world that well. But I mean, like I was saying earlier, I learned about you through the Conductor Cam collaboration with Rob McClure, which, you know, was Broadway musical theater land. But I wanted to hear about how that collaboration came to be, because Ragtime, I mean, those orchestrations, the arrangement, those musical terms. I mean, I was so raw after that. Like, it was all so beautiful. I was weeping. I had chills, all the things. I want to hear how it came to be.
Well, firstly, thank you for watching. And, you know, I tell everyone, like, that is the most important thing I will ever do in my career. You know, and my career could be like 10, 15 years long, or it could be 2 years long. But that, right, that to me is my pinnacle. You know, the way that came about was interesting. So Rob had emailed me, and it was right after George Floyd and all of the social unrest. And, you know, I'll be honest, I had gotten like email fatigue, because there were so many people all of a sudden like, hey, we have this thing. Would you like to be on our board? Or like, hey, we're doing it. And I'd be like, I'm so done, you know? And so when Rob emailed me, I'll be honest, my first thought was like, okay, here's another white guy with like guilt, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, like straight up. But, you know, I kept rereading the email and I was just like, okay, but there's something about just the way it was worded. And so I responded and I said, you know, what's different about you? And I told him, I was like, because I've gotten so many emails in the past 2 months from people basically wanting me to be their token. I was like, how are you different? You know? And his response was so sincere, you know? And if you know Rob McClure, he is such a sincere sweetheart, you know? And so reading his response, I thought, okay, this, he and I need to have a conversation. And so he told me about his beyond his conductor cam series that he has. And I'll be honest, I didn't know anything about him beforehand. But, you know, I looked him up and I saw how accomplished he was. And I went and looked at some of the conductor cams and I was like, oh, these are great, you know. And so he told me his idea. And kind of after having a dialogue, we talked for maybe an hour and a half, you know, and I thought, yeah, let's totally do this. And so some of the ideas that we threw around was conducting to ragtime. But then also after ragtime, I was supposed to conduct an orchestra filled with musicians of color in a piece by a composer of color. And after all of the ideas were scaled down, it was kind of like, okay, this might just be too much. You know, what if we did X, Y, and Z? And then we talked about adding in some of my poetry because I had just written Tethered Voices as well as another poem. And then I also had a poem called The Story Behind the Music. And so I was like, you know, these are some ideas. Which do you prefer? And so, you know, Rob was like, oh, I think this was great. This could work too. But then later he responded, he said, you know, I'm not going to tell you what poem you should use for your segment. He's like, because this is your segment and I want you to feel as though we have equal partnership in this. And I really appreciated that because it honestly was a dialogue. It honestly was two people collaborating together, not one person saying, well, this is what I think you should do. So, I mean, yeah, you know, just putting the video together was a lot of fun, even though we were in two separate places, but.
But like, you know, the video magic, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the video magic was all him, you know, and even the editing, I mean, it was all him. And I think the one thing that we talked about, and I'm so glad that he was able to do, especially was, after I recite my poem and the lines, I'm tired of not being seen, you know, I go from black and white to color.
Yes.
And so he and I had initially talked about that. And so when he sent me the rough edit, I was like, hey, I was like, this is great. But what happened to the, you know, the black and white to color? And, you know, he said it was very difficult to do. And so he wasn't sure if he could do it. And I was like, oh, okay. But I think that could make it, you know, so he said, let me try. And so he tried it and he sent me the second draft. And I was like, this is it.
Right.
You know? And what's cool is two of my friends are in that video. One's a violin player. The other is the principal flute of Memphis Symphony. You know, so it's such a special collaboration for me. And I was just so honored that Rob, you know, sent me that email and that we were able to do this together. Because it's like I said, it's so important to me. And it will always be important to me.
I mean, it was... Yeah. Yes. I love hearing you say that because it was so powerful and it was so moving. And just from my interactions with Rob McClure, he is so kind and generous. And I'm just like so happy to hear that it was an equal partnership like you're saying it was, and that you had the space to share Tethered Voices and talk to him, you know, about your vision and take on it all. And it was just because all of that was so necessary to make it a complete piece, you know?
Mm-hmm. No, I totally agree with you, you know, and yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I don't really have words. I mean, because I could gush about Rob forever because he, like I said, he's just such a kind human. And he's also a talented human, you know, and he really looks out for and supports his colleagues. And so, yeah, I'm so glad that video is out into the universe, and that he shared his platform with me. And then I guess one other thing I wanted to say about that was he made it very clear that he wanted to use his platform to accentuate or highlight marginalized voices, you know? And that was the thing, was that when we were talking about it, he said, basically, I want to step aside and let those who are more qualified come into the light, you know? And I was like, that's deep, sir. But it was less about, oh, I'm white male, you know, let me step aside. No, but it was honestly like, I'm being genuine in this gesture, in that it's time that we see other more qualified beings in these spaces.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you could feel that genuine energy though. And like, I mean, I watched it multiple times then. Mm-hmm. I watched it before this interview and let's be honest, I will probably watch it again right after, right? It's so good. And so I wanted to hear about your poetry experience, like since it was so integral to the video. And And does your poetry and music, like, do they work to inform each other, or how are they in conversation with each other?
You know, I think, I don't know that they necessarily inform each other, but I think they, the way they converse is that poetry, at least my poems, are very rhythmic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a musician, you have to have good rhythm, or at least have some sense of rhythm. Right. But no, you know, so... And it's so weird because at the height of the pandemic back in March, you know, a lot of people didn't know what was going on. We didn't know how long this was going to last, you know. And so I had no desire to play violin, to conduct, to study music, nothing. But then all of a sudden, because of the different emotions that I was feeling, you know, because of the pandemic and just being at home and feeling isolated and, you know, just all these things, that's when I started seeing words. So the way that I write is very interesting. Is usually they come out of nowhere, and I just start seeing words and different stanzas and different phrases that kind of go through my mind. And I either have to grab a pen and paper to write them down really quickly, because if I don't, then I lose them, or I'll grab my phone and I'll speak a voice memo so that I have them later. And so that's actually what happened with Tethered Voices. You know, it's like I was sitting down watching TV, and all of a sudden I saw that first line, and I said, oh, I was like, there's a poem that's about to be born. And so I just started writing. And I think that poem was written in all of 20, 30 minutes, maybe.
Wow. So it just poured out of you.
Yeah. I mean, that's usually how my poems go. And that's usually how writing happens for me. I mean, between, I want to say June and August, I wrote a good 6 poems. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's one, because there was so much going on in society. And 2, it was like my soul had something to say. And usually poetry for me is the way that I say it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you know what I loved about the poem too, specifically? I mean, because there was like a lot to love, but what's in my mind right now is that I really appreciated how you highlighted how racism impacts different parts of our lives. And I'll give the specific example I'm thinking of, which is when you said, I'm tired of the anxiety of when my brother leaves the house. And maybe it was like the next line or a couple stanzas later, you say, and I'm tired of code switching. And it's like, yes, because it impacts mental health, you know, whether it's thinking of being shut out on the streets, or also something is, I guess I want to say subtle, in terms of interactions with people and having to be, you know, having to present in a certain way. So I guess bravo is really what I'm trying to say, but I just think those are important nuances to highlight.
Thank you. But no, it's really true. You know, like my friends joke. They're like, oh, you got your Becky voice on today? You know, because like my professional voice is, let me switch into it really quick. I was about to say right quick, but that's me being colloquial. But like, right. No, my professional voice, it's pitched a little bit higher. And then the diction becomes even more so clearer, just so that I come across as less threatening. Whereas if I'm speaking with my friends, it's like, okay, you can tell that's Kalina right there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it's like, who, I hate to say this, but what person of color doesn't code switch?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. I mean, yeah, it's true. No, it's so true. And I don't know. I feel like it's something that hasn't been discussed in the mainstream, right, as much, like, in terms of the conversation about racism. But it has to be addressed systemically in order for things to change.
Oh, I totally agree with you. And then my second question to that is always, but who's going to be leading that conversation?
Right, sure.
You know what I mean? Meaning, like, if I'm at a table with my colleagues and the topic of discussion is code switching, is everyone going to be looking at me? Because I'm going to be like, oh, I'm sorry. This is a conversation I've had many a times. I don't need to talk about code switching. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's like, I don't need to talk about it with you all. I was like, if anything, you all should be leading the discussion on code switching. Mm-hmm. Not the person of color in the room. It's almost like, you know, my best friend, anytime she says they have diversity training, they look at her to be like, oh, so, you know, what are your thoughts for leading this? And she's like, why am I leading this?
Right.
Why is the Black person leading diversity training today?
Right. It's like, unless you are paying me or it is like my job description, then y'all can be having conversations about how y'all can take action.
Exactly. You know, and something one of my good friends always used to say in high school, you know, and I was like, you stupid, you funny. But it's actually true. You know, he'd be like, the hardest job he's ever had is being a Black man in America.
Mm.
And it's like, where is the lie? Because it's so true.
It is. It is. It seems like, you know, June was such an interesting time because it seemed like it sparked, right, these conversations around anti-blackness and racism in the mainstream, you know, for like non-black folks, I guess, specifically. And because people weren't distracted by their daily lives, but it's the sustainability and like the timeline of when we, quote, go back to real life that I'm curious of how it's all going to continue. But I mean, you know, folks seem to be like, you know, holding the powers that be accountable and continuing to have the conversations, which gives me hope because I tend to spiral and get overwhelmed. But, you know, artists, like, I think art is such a great way to make change, and I think we can continue to push and press forward. Yeah, enough of my spiraling. You are great. I feel like I could, I mean, if you wrote a book, I would buy it. Like, I could talk to you for hours and hours because I just find your life and your work and your journey so exciting and fascinating. But for tonight, we'll wrap up the podcast with two final questions. One being, if you could recommend a piece of black art for our listeners to take in, what would it be?
Oh, a piece of black art. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind, this is so random, is this band that I've been loving right now. they're a band from London called Bring Me the Horizon. They're basically like a screamo metal band. So I would definitely say check out their new album. I think it's post-survival something horror, but it's amazing.
Okay, yes. Well, I mean, screamo heavy metal is like one of those genres like country or even classical where it feels so like white that I would not expect black musicians to be in it, but that's on me, and that's like, you know, but it's all that, but like I was saying earlier with Nina Simone, like it's exciting to people to see black musicians be able to pursue the music they want to pursue, right? Like regardless of the genre, you know, it should be, everyone should be able to pursue the music they want to do. But look at it, you're out here educating me like you do.
Yeah, you know, like it's kind of like black musicians in classical music. You have to find us. You have to seek us out.
Right.
You know, right. It's almost like, I mean, I will say Bring Me the Horizon, they're all white. But if you want black musicians.
Yeah, give us some melanin.
Rage Against the Machine.
Oh, my God. I'm pretty sure my high school boyfriend listened to them. So shout out to my high school boyfriend. But yeah, I know who you're talking about.
Oh, yeah. Because you had Tom Morello and Zach De La Roca and you were just like, I'm done. You know, plus they were kind of a political activist band. But yeah.
Okay, good to know. Like classical music during the day and then screamo heavy metal at night. I love it. I can't wait to research all of this. So then for the second question, if you could give a shout out to a fellow black artist, who would it be? And if you want to do a top five or top 10, that's great too.
Oh, hold on. Let me think about this for 1 second. Actually, yeah, I would like to. I think I have maybe like a top two. I have a top one, to be quite honest with you. She is not a musician, but it is my best friend. And the reason she gets love is because she is a black science professor and she just got a brand new job teaching. So she will be moving back to California to teach at UCSD. And I'm so proud of her because, you know, we have been friends since I was 12 and she was 11. So I think we're going on 26 years now. Just to see everything that she has done, you know, I'm so super proud of her. So she totally gets some love right now. Yeah.
Well, shout out. Very cool. Well, I'm obsessed with you. You do have a lifelong fan in me.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. No, I'm so glad we got to talk and hear about your journey tonight. And if folks want to follow you to keep up with your journey, where can they do that?
All right. So you can totally find me on my website, which is KalinaBovell.com. I also have Facebook. And so sometimes I don't always add people on Facebook because my Facebook is private. So shoot me a message and say, hey, I heard your podcast. And that will be a guaranteed way to get added. And then you can also find me on Instagram, either at Kalina Bovell or it's Silver Smile. Silver spelled with a U as opposed to an E.
Yes. And I can testify, y'all. I DM'd Kalina after the Conductor Cam series and she responded. So you can go give her some love and she'll respond.
Oh, I always respond because I think it's so important to establish a connection. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for your time today. I'm so glad we got to chat, and I can't wait to see you soar.
Thank you, and thank you so much for having me. Like, this was super cool and so much fun.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. Yes, it was our pleasure. And thank you to the listeners for tuning in, and just the admin stuff that I always forget because I'm so about the conversation. Make sure you're following us on social media. Call and Response NYC is the Instagram where I am posting the most. And make sure that you're subscribing and rating and reviewing on iTunes and all the things. And y'all, we are on all platforms officially, so you can listen to wherever you get your podcasts, which I guess you know because you're listening to us right now. And we have a website, so make sure to check out Kalina's information and all of our previous guests who have little, you know, articles about them on callandresponsepodcast.com. Until next time, y'all.